Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news and headlines and hopefully provide some insight and analysis and practical application that you can take back into the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And we judge with low confidence that the NSA is moving into the ransomware business to fill some holes in their black budget. But don't worry, kiddos. They're only going after the Russians and the Chinese. All right. So the first article we have is the U.S. accuses China of using criminal hackers in cyber espionage operations. And this comes to us mainly from Dark Reading, although there are several other articles that we're going to reference, and you can find those in the show notes. So the quick summary is about 4 months ago, there was a massive attack on Microsoft Exchange servers, and they've attributed that to China. And the U.S. has come out with an indictment against four Chinese nationals, which are blaming them for those attacks as well as other attacks that have occurred since 2011.
So I have one small bone to pick with the title. Criminal hackers? I mean, if they're hired by the government, is criminal exactly the right word here?
Well, I might go along with your point of view. I mean, Richard Nixon said he's not a crook, right? And he is famously saying, well, when the president does it, it's not illegal.
There have been multiple presidents that have asserted that.
And I'm sure all of them believe it. You know, some are just smart enough not to say it out loud. I think that I have two basic opinions on this. You know, one is if the Chinese government has hackers attacking foreign governments and their defense contractors, I see that as that's just the way stuff happens. That's espionage. That's always, you know, that's the way it goes. We're doing it against them. They're doing it against us. I think the criminal part comes in where they attack non-government affiliated organizations, pharmaceutical companies, and so on, which, you know, there are several technology targets. So I guess you call them, what's the word? And the term eludes me right now, but particular target areas where they were looking, where these attackers were particularly targeting to get the technologies. You know, submersibles, which I thought was kind of interesting. I assume that means submarines. Autonomous vehicles, which is also interesting because I'm not aware of a huge Chinese vehicle manufacturer off the top of my head. So kind of wondering where that's going.
Maybe they want to become a large international manufacturer of autonomous vehicles. Maybe we're about to have a whole couple, like a surprise manufacturer that makes very Tesla-like cars or very, you know, electric Ford F-150
and they
like
will call
cars.
It Edison. And high-speed rail, of course, that's governments are all in on rail. Aircraft, obviously, makes complete sense. I should have looked into this before, but I think they have a mirror image of the F-35, you know, Chinese version of F-35.
But why would they want that?
What I was thinking here, it was actually a United States covert plan to give China crappy aircraft. Some of the other technologies, genetic sequencing and research around different viruses such as Ebola, MERS, HIV. So nothing really surprising in that list. So in the indictment, they said they have a high degree of confidence in the that China is behind all of this activity. And if you look at the intelligence community's definition of high confidence, that means it's based on high quality information, which allows them to come to a solid judgment on their for their conclusions. So if judging with a high degree of confidence and high confidence are actually equivalent, then at least the drafters of the document believe they have very good information that the Chinese were behind all these attacks, which I think is really difficult considering some of the statements that were coming out of the White House as well as the FBI and basically DOJ around this, because the during the exchange incident 4 months ago, we were talking about how about 30,000 systems were affected by this. And it seems unlikely that the Chinese would have attacked 30,000 systems because they don't have infinite resources to actually leverage those systems to gain the advantages that they're talking about here as far as getting this intellectual property and things of that nature from here.
Yeah, this is kind of like the SolarWinds one where they hit thousands of companies and only really, you know, dived into a couple hundred and then only really like penetrated, you know, some several dozen. But I bet they could grab, you know, exchange, same of the email files. I bet they could just grab the email archives wholesale and worry about them later. It's always a possibility too.
Well, the thing with the SolarWinds though is it was a little bit indiscriminate in who got the vulnerable version of SolarWinds because it was sent through the update mechanism. Whereas the, in this case, the exchange servers were online and they would have had to have been directly targeted.
Yeah, but it's still kind of indiscriminate because you don't know what company has those. If there's, you know, for every company that mattered to them, there are probably 100 companies that, you know, sold paint or something.
Right, but if you're targeting the internet though, you know which IP address belongs to your targets and which ones don't in general.
Yeah, still kind of indiscriminate.
I disagree. Well, I think that what happened was that there were a lot of attacks against exchange servers. The Chinese were responsible for some of those. And the rest of that was a lot of other attackers taking advantage of the situation.
So they're not saying that all 30,000 hacked exchange servers not China.
That's what the articles that I read were saying, though, that they were attributing 30,000 to China. At least that's the impression I got from the articles, but it could be my reading comprehension is not great.
I don't know. I figure my impression was that they were just kind of sweeping through and just doing a large sweep, trying to grab whatever information they could at the time, knowing that they probably weren't going to be in there forever. And this was too noisy to really be long-term thing.
But the way that I'm thinking about it is that even if they were doing indiscriminate acquisition of a bunch of email from everybody on the internet, they still have to be able to have the resources to sift through it on the back end. And you're obviously going to get less value. There's going to be more noise to signal in that amount of email that you're going to pull back. Yeah. Now, we're talking about this disparity between what seems to be the statements from the DOJ and the White House. So the DOJ actually came out and charged four Chinese nationals and affiliated them with the Chinese government. But the White House has come out and said that China has fostered an intelligence enterprise that includes contract hackers who conduct unsanctioned cyber operations worldwide, including for their own profit. Now that kind of seems to be along with a second quote from Joe Biden, who said one reason the U.S. has not imposed sanctions against China over the cyber attacks is that the Chinese government is not doing this themselves. They're simply fostering the environment that allows it to happen. So it seems like they're split on really what's going on here, either the Chinese government doing it or they're allowing it to happen.
I mean, it could be both. I mean, there's been a lot of talk. I mean, you know, whenever we sit down and kind of hang out and talk, or we'll talk about how Russia is not persecuting hackers within their borders as long as they're targeting the U.S. and kind of the same with China. I mean, it could be people working after hours too. That would definitely make it difficult to like track down like what's state sponsored and what's not.
And I think that would actually be kind of interesting. I'm not sure if that would really be the smartest thing. So imagine that, the Chinese government has 10 guys on staff or whatever for cyber espionage. And they say, well, as a bonus, you guys can leverage our tech infrastructure to do your own after-hours ransomware stuff as a bonus to beef up your salaries.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's how they got the attribution. Maybe it wasn't during the APT attacks or whatever. Maybe they managed to track back some of those personal attacks where they weren't quite as
And
careful.
that's why I'm thinking that either they were doing it actually without the Chinese government sanction, or China doesn't really care about attribution or not. Because if they're saying, well, you can do this for your own personal business, they are probably not going to be necessarily using the same TTPs and all that for their personal attacks, which is going to increase the likelihood that that's going to be tracked back to them, as well as just the increased number of attacks against potentially not targeting areas that the Chinese government isn't interested in, which is going to draw increased attention. Whereas if the Chinese government were doing this just for their own attacks, they'd be targeting, the government and its defense contractors. Whereas if these guys are doing it after hours on their own, they're going to attack anybody that they think can pay out.
Yeah, no, that seems to me like a great way to kind of hide attribution, where you can say, yeah, we didn't tell anybody to do this. No, we're just talking about. It's kind of the same way that Russia lets the gangs, the ransomware gangs, run around and do their own thing, and then maybe occasionally when they find something of interest to the Russian government, they slip it. That is low confidence information, by the way. I'm just hypothesizing. So, but I mean, you were talking about like those 30,000 exchange attacks. You know, what if they hit five or six of them, or 10 or 20 of them for Chinese government purposes, and then they hit 50 of them themselves.
Well, that's possible, but what I'm thinking about, the why it seems counterintuitive from my perspective is that the more that takes place, the harder it is to hide from it. So for instance,
Yeah.
or for in this situation, let's say China was interested in five companies. So they hit those five companies with the exchange attack, right? And then 30,000 more or 25,000 more, however many when you count, other attacks take place, actually kind of brings that vulnerability to the forefront and say, oh, well, this is a mass incident. It gets more people focused on looking for compromises and things like that, whereas five would have flown under the radar.
Oh yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think that that's kind of a strategy decision on their part. Do we try and be super low and slow and quiet, or do we blast it all out there and kind of dare people to pick out which ones are
So
important?
hiding in the noise.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm not saying that it's one or the other. And they're just both potential.
Yeah, and actually a quote from one of the Chinese government officials said in about attribution explains why this is challenging. They say, given the virtual nature of cyberspace and the fact that there are all kinds of online actors who are difficult to trace, it's important to have enough evidence in investigating and identifying cyber-related incidents. It requires extra prudence when linking cyber attacks with government of when the with the government of any country. These so-called technical details released by the United States side do not constitute a complete chain of evidence.
It's interesting that he uses chain of evidence, given that that's a very loaded kind
I
of
don't know
legal
about
term.
loaded legal term, but it is a definite legal term, and maybe he used it because of the indictment saying that they want to charge or they have charged those four Chinese nationals with crimes.
Yeah, but the chain of evidence is more around, you know, who owns the evidence, who possesses it, which is something that I was thinking about as I was reading this. Would anybody that didn't already believe the US believe any evidence that the US could produce about this? It's not too difficult to produce, you know, text logs and kind of create the sort of evidence that would show that somebody
Well,
did
chain of
something they
evidence
shouldn't have.
talks about all the way from identification and acquisition
Chain of custody, yeah.
through you know, storage and eventually presented it in court to ensure that it has not been tampered with through that entire process.
Yeah. You know what? I'm probably reading too much into this. I'm not sure if he meant this as a, I don't know if we should be diving into that at all or just ignoring it.
I mean, the bottom line is attribution is hard, and you can accuse the Chinese of being guilty of this, but are you really certain? Do you have solid evidence that is really going to clearly demonstrate that?
Yeah. So what kind of evidence would, do you think, on like a national scale like this, what kind of evidence would be enough to tie somebody to a specific hack? Because you'd have to be able to tie their computer to it. You'd have to have like the IP record showing they connected to it. Then you'd have to have evidence from the computer itself showing they were the one logged on. You need potentially some kind of record to show that that IP address belonged to that computer at that time. So you need at least three things.
And it would be really difficult to do that considering that those computers are located in China.
I know, right? You'd almost have to be on the system. You'd have to like hack them back and be on the system, pulling evidence from the system showing they logged in, or at least maybe DHCP logs or something, or network log showing that that system was owned by them at the time. And then the translation log showing that this internal IP address maps to that external IP address at this time.
Right. There's a lot there. And that, actually, this got me thinking about wondering whether, you know, this is really kind of a publicity stunt kind of thing. Because I'm thinking, let's say that, you know, the FBI identified these four guys and they believe these guys are actual criminals. They could have gone to the Chinese and said, hey, we have evidence that these four guys are conducting criminal activity in the United States. And try to work with the Chinese law enforcement to get the evidence in order to actually charge them with crimes versus espionage. It's more like the US government says, oh, well, these four guys are conducting espionage on behalf of the Chinese government, so we'll call it a crime so we can feel righteous in our accusation. Because I was thinking about the if the shoe's on the other foot, that we've got Americans.
But never do that. We would never do that.
Well, I'm just thinking about just from an espionage perspective, though. Let's just assume that, you know, no one from the United States government is conducting illegal computer attack operations. But just from an espionage perspective, the United States government's connecting espionage against the Chinese using computers or virtual infrastructure, however you want to say it, in the cyber realm. Would we want the Chinese to say, oh, well, these four NSA guys who are probably in the military are guilty of crimes, cyber crimes, and we're going to, you know, have arrest warrants for them? It's like trying to have your cake and eat it too.
I don't know. Definitely there's something around there, kind of around, we don't, at least in the US, we hear a lot about these attacks that other countries do, and we don't hear about the kinds of things we do, which I don't know if that means that we're just really good at attacking these other countries, or we're just not hearing them because of a, you know, media thing only covering certain attacks.
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing. And I'm not sure how it goes. Because obviously we employ humans just like they do who make mistakes. So it seemed unlikely that all of our cyber espionage activity is completely below the radar and we haven't been caught. I mean, they were able to trace Stuxnet back to the United States and Israel. So that was imperfect. And I'm sure once the Vault 7 leaks came out, as well as, what was the other one? There was another one where NSA attack tools got out. I forget what it was called.
Shadow brokers.
Right, exactly. So once those came out, I'm sure that the IOCs from those were used by adversarial entities, both government and non-government, to look to see if the United States had gotten in to their systems. Mm-hmm. But some of the other interesting things from the indictment was mentioning the relationship between the Chinese government and universities and front companies created by the universities as well.
So another thing that our government would never do, front companies, or work with universities.
Not. Yeah, we would not have created a DARPANET to connect universities to each other for defense contracting
purposes. No, nor would we recruit young, impressionable men and women to come work for our warmongering organizations.
Yeah. Yeah. We wouldn't have an ROTC or anything like that, or give grants to universities to conduct defense research, or no, absolutely not.
No. Immoral.
Yeah. Beyond the pale.
Beyond the pale. Yeah. That was interesting that they called that out specifically in the indictment. I didn't understand that at all. I'll be honest, I'm not sure I understand the indictment. Although I did hear on a Lawfare podcast earlier this week that one of the people there thinks that the purpose of the indictment is to scare anyone that ever wants to work internationally. Because since one of them was a contractor, and they're hoping to scare future people that want to, you know, eventually move into the private sector. Because if they have a warrant on their heads, then they can't, you know, come into the U.S. and work here. They can't, you know, travel internationally at anybody that has a treaty with the U.S. because they'll get picked up and shipped off to the U.S. to face the warrant. I don't really have a follow-up for that. That sounds interesting, but I don't know how many people really want to leave China. And therefore, I don't know how much power that has.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about the circumstances over there where, you know, you have an option to either work for the government or work privately and maybe eventually leave the country. I guess it really would depend on the disbursement of the technical jobs in the government versus the private sector. And considering that China is still a communist country, where is the dividing line between the government and the private sector?
The private sector is the government in some ways, right?
So I'm not sure that you're really going to scare anybody when the options are limited in a, you know, communist country as far as their relationship to the government goes.
Yeah. All right. Well, we spent
maybe just convince them to be poor at their job. Just don't be good. Don't be a good hacker. Don't be good at it.
You can't go to DEF CON anymore. That's really the.
So along with the indictment, they've released a associated documents that have IOCs and TTPs associated with all these attacks that they've seen since 2011. So some of these things are pretty old and may not be of much value, but you can find them and they'll be referenced in the show notes about where the IOCs are at. The TTPs are basically 50% of the MITRE attack framework.
Yeah, it's so I'm
not
broad.
Sure there's a lot of value there.
And you know what? There almost isn't at this point anymore because there's so many different threat actors and they're doing so many different things. I'm not sure you can afford to really ignore any of the major attack vector TTPs anymore. Like I'm sure if you look at the matrix, there's probably some things in there that aren't, you know, big things that a lot of people hit. But the ones listed in here, it talks about phishing. It talks about attacking external infrastructure. It talks about using good accounts to log in, like, you know, compromised accounts and shared passwords and stuff like that. Like those are all things that if you're not guarding against, if you're not already covering in some way, then you're already compromised. So there's nothing really defining in this report.
Yeah, one of the things that might be valuable about the MITRE attack framework, and I'm not sure if someone's already working on this or has done this or not, but rather than saying, here's the MITRE attack framework, and here are the TTPs that are leveraged by this threat actor or that threat actor, just throwing all of them together and saying, these are the TTPs that are most used by most threat actors that are known today. And just kind of rank them or count them or whatever and say, okay, so these are the ones you should focus on because most of the threat actors are leveraging these today.
So you can do that with the MITRE Navigator. It's got layers for all the threat actors that are picked out in there, and you can use kind of the scoring engine to, you know, add them up and do that. That might be where, I don't know, but I don't know if anybody's actually done it and kind of published the results and been like, here are the techniques that you 100% have to have. And here are the techniques that are, you know, very uncommonly used. And maybe once you, or at least a prioritization matrix, that would make some sense.
Yeah. I mean, especially if you were able to get somebody like, you know, Mandiant to throw their stuff on there, and then you overlay it with the Verizon stuff and, you know, all the major response vendors, if they were to throw those numbers on there, that would probably give you a good picture.
Yeah, no, it's even better
trying to figure it out for yourself.
Yeah, no, it's even better with what you're talking about. Cause what I was talking about was using the existing layers from the APT actors that are in there, but no, you're right. Cause using the existing APT actors that are in there doesn't give you any idea on how often they're used by, you know, different, like, you know, this APT actor only hit, you know, one bad guy. This APT actor hit 50 or 50 good guys or companies or whatever. And the incident response companies, they would have that information based on how many incidents they responded to. So you get a lot better idea, I think, of which one was used, how often.
Right. And not only that, but they could also use it in relation to all the attacks they've seen. So not only was this attack hit more often, mm-hmm. but it was actually 90% of all the attacks seen as well.
Yeah, because they give you kind of that stuff. They'll tell you, like, you know, phishing is the most popular now, and then now we're going back to web things. But
yeah, but it's not tied to the framework that I can remember.
Yeah, actually, I haven't actually looked at the 2021. We had talked about doing an episode on that, so maybe we should at some point take a look and see if it's in there, because maybe they're smarter than we are, and if they're not, maybe we can go tell them.
I say the first part's more likely than the second part.
Article two comes from Krebs. It's one of my favorite articles. It's called "Don't Want to Pay Ransom Gangs? Test Your Backups." And the reason it's one of my favorite articles is because it is a very solid single topic article. It doesn't try to cover everything in the world. It doesn't try to spend a ton of time hypothesizing. He really focuses on one big topic, and that is that one of the reasons that ransomware gangs have been so effective is that so many businesses haven't actually tested and validated their backups and confirmed that the backups worked. And in this article, he talks about three main issues people run into. The first one is trying to restore petabytes of data over a single pipe. Number two, the backup key, software instructions, or procedure are encrypted by the ransomware, because it was on, you know, some network admin's system somewhere. Or number three, the ransomware encrypts the backups too, which, you know, happens sometimes. So in terms of discussion points on here, there's a bunch of questions that you should be asking yourself, like, does your backup work? Have you actually done the backup and validated that you were able to restore systems from the backup? So I don't know how many companies actually go back and run the backup and restore back to the previous point and validate that everything's correct, but I imagine it's not 100%.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges with actually doing that is it could affect production.
Mm-hmm.
And people do not want to affect production by running these kind of tests.
Yeah, so they'll run them in dev or whatever, but dev is usually smaller and doesn't have the same data and, you know, doesn't have the production workload.
And the systems might be different.
Yeah, they're supposed to be mirrors, but they rarely are. So another question or discussion point on this is, where is the backup? Is the backup on site? Is the backup in an external facility? What kind of connection is there to the backup? An example used in the article was someone whose backup was in a 30-mile away facility, and they only had a very small connection. It was not fiber. It was not a gig. It was something less than that. Another item to think about is, how long does it take to restore? I have a quote here from Fabian Wosar, Chief Technology Officer at MCSoft. Suddenly, the victim notices they have a couple petabytes of data to restore over the internet, and they realize that even with their fast connections, it's going to take 3 months to download all these backup files. And so the question there is, have you done the math to figure out exactly how long it's going to take you to do your backups? I'm sorry, restore your backups. take your bandwidth that's available, take the size of all the backups, and start getting a rough idea, you know, order of magnitude. How long is it going to take to download all that information, let alone restore it, but just download it? Is it 10 hours? Is it 50 hours? Is it 5 years? And then with all the people working at home, that's actually probably a benefit in some cases if you're trying to do any kind of restores at home. Although with the home computers, you have the added fun of having your IT desk reimage all of them. As David mentioned when we talked before this, people at home may not have to reimage or may not back up their entire computer. They'll only back up the data in their, you know, My Documents or their OneDrive folder. So the backup is less of a problem there, but now you've got to get everybody's computers restored.
Well, not only that, but if you're talking about, let's imagine that you're in an organization where everyone's remote, they may not be near a facility where they can just drive into the office and have it re-imaged. They might have to FedEx it or something like that.
Yeah. And the same team that's trying to do the restores on the servers may be also trying to get those computers back out to everybody too.
Yeah, well, hopefully you have a server team and a desktop team. So your desktop team can focus on the desktops and your server team can focus
on servers. I get that. But in an all hands on deck situation like this, you may have to kind of focus people. You may have to be like, all right, getting these servers up back into production is, you know, critical to the business versus getting the people's computers back up.
Well, it depends. Because if your business relies on your employees to be, you know, using their workstations, it would be difficult for you to pick and choose which you want to have up.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I think that's one of the things that you have to consider is, you know, you're talking about in a business continuity disaster recovery plan, you have tier 1, 2, and 3 services. And if you're going to have those, which you should be able to identify, you know, what is your tier 0? That absolutely you have to get them up right away so you can restore those right away. But if you're in a scenario where not only may your tier 1 servers and services be down, or your tier 0, however you want to rank it, but are the employees who need to access that, if they're affected by this event, are they going to be included in that tier 1, tier 0 restore? So they can start leveraging those services when they come back online.
Yeah, I imagine that'd be, yeah, if you don't have like AD back up and running, you don't have email back up and running, getting your end users online is probably potentially a waste of time.
Right. And imagine if your end users need to be able to interface with customers, and that's how you get your business. How you generate revenue is your employees interacting with customers versus them interacting with a website or something like that. It does no good for them to interact with the employees if your employee computer is down and they can't perform their work. I was saying, and with the tier 1, 2, and 3 and all that, this is where your recovery time objective comes into play to say that the amount of time an application or system can be down without causing significant damage, what is that time? And can you actually, if you actually practice and verify that you can meet that time? Because it's all well and good to say you have a recovery time objective of 4 hours on critical systems or 2 hours on critical systems. But are you certain you can meet that RTO?
Yeah. All right. Further discussion, kind of make sure, you know, this is actually just rolling right into what you should do about it. So make sure that you know what is the application that does the backup. Having that application that does your backup get encrypted itself, or the information, I guess technically the application probably wouldn't be encrypted. They tend to encrypt the other files, but making sure that, you know, your standard work documentation, your procedures, any passwords, any keys, any certificates related to that, all your documentation and the application itself is somewhere where it's not going to get encrypted. And making sure your backup is not completely encryptable as well. So all discussion points.
Right. So if you're relying on your DC plan in order to get you back up and running, make sure it is not going to be encrypted so you can't access it. you know, have it offline or have a copy of it printed out or something, so that you still have access to those plans should something like this happen.
Yeah. So what should you do about it? As I, like I said, I realized about halfway through the discussion points that I was just doing the what should you do about it there. So, but first of all, have a plan for full restore that's not just restore everything. David mentioned tier 1, 2, 3 and making sure you have a recovery time objective and figuring out where each of your applications and each of your services fit in there, which ones have to be restored first, what your dependencies are, et cetera, et cetera.
And practice.
Yeah.
If you have a tier 0 application, you should practice restoring it probably at least once a year, if not more frequently, depending on actually how much time that takes to do and if the business is affected when you do that.
And when you do that, you know, do some math, figure out how long restoring takes, because a lot of times I feel when we do a restore, we only do it on a single system or a couple systems. We're not trying to do a restore across the network. You know, multiply it out. Did it take up all your bandwidth? Did it, you know, if it took 20 minutes or an hour or 2 hours and it took up all your bandwidth, multiply it by the number of servers you have and how big each one is. Make sure that you have copies of the backup restore software and any certificates, keys, instructions. Dave mentioned that a little bit earlier. You mentioned making sure your business continuity and disaster recovery plan, there's hard copies somewhere or they're offline. Make sure your backups can't be encrypted, like the, making sure they're offline or there's a copy of them offline somewhere. Take the time to do the math and figure out how long restoring it would take. And then figure out if it's worth doing physical drives versus trying to get over that. I mean, there's always been that kind of joke about how shipping a jumbo jet full of hard drives is faster in terms of bandwidth than, you know, sending something over the network. This is a place where that may be true. And finally, I've got kind of an edge case here. And I don't know, are we calling this a Kasaya scenario from now on? is this a Kasaya incident when a whole bunch of people get ransomware all at once because a third party gets compromised? But anyways, like, what's the edge case if, you know, 500 companies across the internet all get ransomware at once and all of them try to pull their backups from their, you know, AWS or cloud? I don't know if that's even enough to cause a blip in the bandwidth.
Well, imagine if you are outsourcing your backup to someone else, though, and they get ransomware. You better hope that it doesn't happen to you at the same time.
Yeah, well, or actually, I guess the bandwidth does come in if you're using a backup firm and 10 of their customers get ransomware at the same time and they all try to start pulling down, you know, exabytes of information all at the same time.
I had not considered that one.
Be interesting. But yeah,
well, thankfully that'd be pretty rare.
You know, though, but this year we've had 3 mass attacks that have caused widespread. We've got SolarWinds. If they'd pushed out ransomware to all of those companies at once, we had the Exchange, 30,000 systems. Again, if they had pushed out ransomware, in both those cases, they chose not to, but they could have. So there's been 3 times in the past less than 12 months where there could have been widespread ransomware attacks across large swaths of the internet all at once.
Right. Well, that's something that should be in your BC plan about critical vendors.
Yeah.
You know, and how they rate on your ability to actually implement your BC plan or recover.
All right. Well, that's all I have to say about that one. Like I said, it was a pretty simple and straightforward article. Really good, though. I think you should read it.
And it's not long. It's pretty short, but it's straight and to the point.
Quality article.
All right. The third article we have is law firm for Ford, Pfizer, Exxon discloses ransomware attack. This comes to us from Dark Reading. So the summary here is that what seems to be a pretty major law firm of Campbell, Conroy, and O'Neill, which has hundreds of customers and 41 lawyers, got hit with a ransomware attack. And some of the customers of this law firm include Ford. Well, actually, the article said past and present customers, because Ford and General Motors are both listed as customers. And it seems like a conflict of interest if, you know, they were both using the same law firm. But Boeing, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, Home Depot, Exxon, And if you look through their site and look at some of their what they're calling success cases, they also have represented Tesla and Dell, as well as some other large automobile manufacturers in other industries. So their disclosure on this is, it's pretty skeletal. There's not a lot on their page, which gives you any details about exactly what happened. But apparently on the 27th of February, they identified unusual activity and then confirmed that they'd been hit with ransomware. And some of the information that may have been exposed as part of this was the names, dates of birth, driver's licenses, state ID numbers, social security numbers, passports, payment card information, medical health insurance, biometric and or online credential information. So that's a lot of very different information. And we had talked about this in a previous episode about the information that law firms have. And it might be that this is not just customer data, but also discovery information from actual lawsuits that are going on. Because I'm not sure how or why a law firm would need biometric information or medical information about their customers, which makes me think that this probably is actually going to impact some of their current or past litigation efforts. Well, past it might not impact, but maybe relevant to those.
Yeah, the wide variety of information screams that, because there's no good reason. There's no good reason for them to have online account credentials. Like, you know, appropriate methods of handling those is the SALT and HASHM. And having the passport, I guess I can see passport numbers as being important for their employees. But the medical and health insurance stuff, that shouldn't be there at all. The payment card information, they're, as a set of lawyers to a corporate firm, I'm pretty sure they're not getting paid via credit card.
Well, certainly not these guys.
So it makes no sense to me that it would all be coming from the firm itself. And I agree. It has to be discovery related.
Yeah, I bet their hourly rate would max my credit card out.
In about 10 hours.
Or sooner. But I think it'll be interesting in the coming weeks to see what new news comes out about this. Because if they don't pay and they actually have all this discovery information, actually, you know, I think we talked about this before about the number of ways to make money from ransomware. I was just thinking about selling this information to their competitors. Say, oh, we see you're in a legal dispute against this guy. Maybe you would want to know what information those guys have on file about this case.
That's we were talking before about triple payment and quadruple payment. You just found another one, man. So many ways to get paid.
Ransomware is the gift that keeps on giving. It's getting better than to have a trust fund. But some of the statements from the release, I'm not sure exactly what you want to call it, press release or the notice about the event, did not inspire a lot of confidence in their response. Of course, they said they are committed and take very seriously. It's responsible to protect the data that's entrusted to them.
Which is bullshit.
They will give, what are you talking about? They're going to give 24 months credit monitoring.
Yeah, I was looking this up and I was trying to figure out, like, we all know that this has become the standard de facto result. And I was looking at a RIT paper called Quantifying the Cost of Data Breaches, which pulled it off of another paper. When I went to the original paper, it was off the internet, but they said that on average, every victim of identity theft lost $1,000 in the year that their identity was stolen. And I get it, because you can't just reimburse everyone who has their data stolen because you don't know specifically which data was used where, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems like the 24 months of credit card monitoring, which, you know, if you bought it yourself, costs, you know, somewhere in the range of, you know, $360 for 2 years, probably costs them somewhere in the range of $50 because they're buying a whole bunch of it. But that doesn't seem like a fair recompense.
I'd actually like to see the statistics around victims of data breaches? Because I'm thinking at this point, how many Americans have not been part of at least one data breach where their social security number's been had? Yeah.
No, you're right. And I've been involved in a couple, and I haven't had my identity stolen yet. I don't know why not.
No, you better knock on wood.
I just said it, yeah.
Because I know I've been part of at least a half a dozen, and half of those were from government agencies losing my stuff. So I'm just wondering, that's the reason that you won't be able to, that companies won't feel any impact from this kind of thing is like, oh, well, yeah, your stuff got lost in our data breach, but it had already been lost four times before this. So prove that it was this loss versus one of those other four that was actually used in order to, you know, steal your identity or what have you.
I mean, I get that, but I feel like they should do maybe what I'm looking for is more almost a fine where every time they get breached, they should pay the person whose data they lost like $500. Like, sorry for losing your data. You know, you might not get hacked because of this, but you might. So here's a chunk of change to help cover it. Although I guess if they start admitting that kind of fault, they open themselves up to lawsuits, don't they?
Well, maybe they could do it on the front end. Say, oh, well, we're going to collect these pieces of information from you. So that's worth $1,000. So here's $1,000 discount, or here's $1,000 in cash for you providing that data to us, because you can't trust us to actually keep it safe.
You know, I did see there's someone that has that idea where every person's data is worth money, and every time a company or whenever a company wants to collect it, they have to pay you. There's someone who has that idea.
It might be Bruce Schneier.
Maybe.
Because he's working with I wish I would have thought to read up on this before we had this conversation, but he's working with some organization about data portability and data ownership for individuals' data. So you would own your data, and people would request access to that data. They wouldn't have the data, but they would request access to it, that you would control that. Versus, you know, so your data would be in one place versus all these different companies having copies of it. They would pay to access your single copy of it.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And there's an organization or a company that's working on that. And unfortunately, it eludes me at the moment.
All right. So I do have strong feelings on their breach notification. There was no information on how many systems or individuals were affected. They kind of implied that only one system was infected. There was no info on how the bad guys got in, no TTPs. And something that I was actually curious about thinking about it, I was upset that information was not in there, but I don't know how important that is. You know, non-security people probably don't care about that stuff at all.
Well, maybe. I guess, I think other law firms may consider that. So I think when something like this happens, you know, of course, cybersecurity people are interested in all those kind of details, but I think other industry people may be interested in it, because imagine if the way that they got into this law firm was by using a widely used software, or software that's widely used by lawyers,
yeah,
or a third party that's widely used by lawyers or something like that, that could affect other law firms and leave them open or potentially indicate a risk that they don't know they have yet.
Yeah. Speaking kind of on that subject, I think they're probably outsourcing their IT. I imagine a lot of lawyers' offices are probably outsourcing all their stuff that's not lawyer related. I happened to check their careers page. This came out a couple of days ago, and they have no jobs for IT or IT security people, only for more lawyers.
And that's what we need, more lawyers.
So, but that's an interesting thought, because small companies like this, I mean, yeah, they've got 40 lawyers and they represent big companies, but they're not a big company themselves. This is interesting. You were talking about the hacktivist stuff earlier. They're a prime target. They focus on their law. They've got, you know, metric butt tons of information because they're doing all this discovery and all these things. And they probably don't have any dedicated security people at all.
Well, the question would be, you know, they can't be, though, now that I think about it, because they're saying that this was data breach of their systems and not a third party who's storing their stuff. So they have to have some IT infrastructure. Otherwise, well, actually, it is a bunch of lawyers, so they may be nuancing their statements.
I mean, the system could have been the laptop they use. You know, maybe they've got one IT guy that, you know, handles their laptops and, you know, sets up the file share or whatever.
It's probably the receptionist.
It's a flat network.
It's the receptionist desktop.
And they went out and they bought a firewall at Best Buy and or a router at Best Buy that has a built-in firewall and then plugged that into the internet.
It's called Soho for a reason.
Yeah, it says it's got office right in the name.
Yep, twice.
Yeah. That's actually, I wonder if that'd be a lucrative gig. Like going through and securing lawyers' offices. That's probably like a little sub genre of security work.
Well, why does this matter is, you know, based on what we read about the data that was released, it seems like discovery data was lost in this. So if you're outsourcing your legal operations to a law firm, are you asking them questions about how they are storing and protecting the information that you provide them with? I know when you deal with a lot of organizations or third parties, you may ask them for what their SOC 2 looks like. I really doubt that a law firm has a SOC 2 or a SOC 2. So you'll need to have at least developed a questionnaire or something in order to get some kind of idea about how they're actually protecting the information that you give them. Because law firms have a lot of sensitive information. I mean, if you look at the practice areas for this this law firm, asbestos defense, medical malpractice, legal malpractice, personal injury and negligence, pharmaceutical and medical devices, class action lawsuits, the data that they have relating to these types of litigations is incredibly valuable to not only them, but to whoever they're in the opposing litigation with.
Yeah, that's interesting thinking about the discovery part, because while I may have consented to give my information to Ford, I didn't, like, I mean, as an example, I certainly didn't consent to give the information then to this law firm, but I didn't have a choice in that.
Well, I'm sure in the fine print on the Ford site, though, it says our third parties.
Yeah, yeah. I know that's legally it's allowed, but
right. Well, and they were talking about lawyers here. So, you know, they're going to have that kind of detail in there.
Yeah.
But if at all possible, you should try to minimize the amount of information you give them. But obviously that's a double-edged sword because you want to give them as much as they can in order to do their job, in order to provide you the service that you're paying for. But that is going to open you up to quite a bit of risk depending on what the situation is. But I think I'll keep an eye on this one to see what happens in the future, because this could be pretty interesting depending on how it flushes out or how the ransomware gang handles this. And that's it for this article. Matt, you have a couple of follow-ups, though, from previous discussions that we've had.
Well, just there's two things came up as we were talking about this show that we thought were super interesting related to previously newsworthy articles. So, for example, one of them, Vice has an article that NSO, the NSO group related to the Pegasus malware and going after all the journalists and, you know, country leaders, et cetera, says they're not going to talk to the press anymore. So I'm just proud of them for standing up to the mean old press and saying, enough is enough. We're not going to talk to you anymore. You're mean.
Unlike us or pristine angels.
And the second one, David pointed out that Kaseya gets a universal decryptor to help the ransomware victims. Somebody, some kind soul provided them with the universal decryptor, but they said they couldn't get it, right? They couldn't tell you where they got it from?
They said it was from a third party. So Ooh. Maybe it was left on their doorstep like a baby.
I mean, it's a lot less trouble than a baby. Interesting. Yeah, they were, they'd asked for the ransom of $70 million and then lowered it to $50 million and then disappeared. So yeah, my bet is that someone, some red team from the government went out and shut them down and gave them the key.
Now, what's interesting about this is not too long before this came out, I was looking at an article that said, since Revo went offline, what was all those companies who had been ransomware that aren't going to get their key now because Revo's just gone.
Yeah. Yeah. That is interesting. And that looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Dun, 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 dun.